Yes, ma'am.
It's a great pleasure to welcome back the Reverend Dr. Graham Standish to lead our Lenten series on forgiving. The genesis of this series dates back 2 years ago in March when Graham came to lead a series on living a grace-filled life. It was a wonderful series. We all enjoyed it. And we knew that we wanted Graham to come back. But we also knew that we needed to tackle a really hard topic, forgiveness. And not many people want to do that. We had done it in the seminars a number of years before, and we just felt like it was time to do that again because it's something we all face. So we invited Graham, and he graciously agreed. And we were so, so grateful and have been looking forward to this ever since. So he'll be in for a treat. I think given his background and his experience, he is an ideal person to address this topic. Graham is the executive director of the Samaritan Counseling Guidance Consulting and the director of its Caring for Clergy and Congregations program, which offers clergy coaching and church consulting. I think this is a little bit new since the last time you came. He's also a former pastor of Calvin Presbyterian Church in Zelianople and the author of 10 books. He's sought after as a teacher, speaker, and leader, especially in the areas of spirituality and church leadership. And you probably recognize him also from Westminster's pulpit, where he's been a guest preacher. So I would consider Graham a good friend of Westminster and of Presbyterians. And of course, we have a Samaritan Counseling Center at Westminster. So we feel like you're just one of us, Graham. And so
yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Turn it over to you.
Great. Let's start with a prayer. Holy and gracious God, Lord, we thank you for bringing us all together. And also, Lord, for both the willingness and the courage for people to want to stretch and grow spiritually, mentally, emotionally, relationally, in all these different ways. Lord, be with us this morning so that the words we hear and the thoughts we think, they'd be more inspired by you than by me. And Lord, we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. It's just to let you all know kind of the way I'm going to operate. I'm going to be showing you slides, which I think by now you're used to. But I'm going to vacillate back and forth. So what will happen is I will be showing slides and then periodically. Actually, I'm going to ask Sarah and Ted, click on again for a second. I have a question. I know that you have everybody muted and you have everybody kind of not on screen. Part of what I was planning to do was to share scripture and to have people respond. Dialogue work?
People can use their microphones, and the only thing we're not doing is turning on our cameras.
Okay, so just use the raise hand thing so I know who to call on when we kind of throw this out.
Sure, and to the extent that you don't mind people interrupting you, you can encourage people to just pipe up.
Okay. Great, thank you.
We're a genial group.
Good. Well, excuse me. Well, just I'm gonna start showing my slides. But this is a topic that I have been very fascinated with throughout the years. A lot of it has to do not only with my work as a pastor, but also my work as a therapist. And my work as a spiritual director and even clergy coach, I find that one of the things you learn as a therapist, spiritual director, clergy coach, or even as a pastor, is how wounded people are. People are way more wounded than most people realize. I think one of the things we talk a lot about at Samaritan is what makes what we do difficult, and what makes it difficult, you know, for example, even to find people to contribute to our mission, is you can't see what we do. You know, I've often said it's easier to give to the Light of Light mission on the north side, which people should give to, because they, you know, you can see hunger, you can see homelessness, you can see those struggles. The difficulty is when you're doing counseling, you can't open up a door or lift up the roof and look in and see what we do, because the work we do is so personal and it's so intimate and it deals with such deep-seated wounds. And the amazing thing is how often the struggles people have, whatever their wounds are, have to deal with forgiveness. That somebody has done something to them that they can't let go of. And what it does is it causes people to, in many ways, live in their past. Maybe they were bullied in school. Maybe they grew up in an abusive house. Maybe they had a boss somewhere who did something unforgivable or really intrusive. Whatever it is, that often you find that helping them to overcome the wounds, part of it is a certain point where it's, well, how do you let this go? How do you let it go and move on? And it is what makes counseling difficult, because it is so hard for people to forgive. People simply just hold on to wounds for a long time. So this for me has been an interesting, a topic I've been interested in for a long time. And it's also true, by the way, in churches. I should add, so many of the people in churches, their struggles are the inability to forgive. But then that also happens periodically where churches have a hard time forgiving elders or forgiving previous pastors. And one of the things I've noticed in working with pastors is how often pastors have been wounded in churches they serve and how they have a hard time forgiving the churches that have hurt them. And so it's an issue that really spreads throughout Christianity. And yet that's a reason why it was such a foundational issue that Jesus talked about. So over these next 4 weeks, I'm going to be talking about four things. One is, what does it mean to forgive? And this is really just our definition of forgiving, what it is, et cetera. Next week, we're going to talk about what makes forgiving so hard, what just gets in the way of our letting go of wounds and pains and things and being able to forgive other people. The third week, I'm going to look into how to forgive. Although that may actually become the fourth week. I haven't decided. I may switch weeks three and four. And then finally, obstacles and opportunities. What are the obstacles that come on culturally, personally, familially, ethnically, racially, everything else, and what become opportunities to do that? I want to begin by sharing a video with you all. And it's a video that is, let's give you a second. It's a video that of a story that I find really inspirational. The guy you're looking at right there is Bud Welch, and Bud Welch, Bud Welch's daughter ended up dying in the Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh. And as a result of that, he really had a struggle with how is he going to live his life? Is he going to live his life in the grips of the anger and hurt, or is he going to live his life in another way? And so this is him talking in this 3-minute video about his encounter with Timothy McVeigh's father in Buffalo. And I'll just let you watch.
Is the act forgivable? Actually, the act is not forgivable. But to forgive the perpetrator, the person that did the act, I think that's possible. I know it's possible for me. My 23-year-old daughter, Julie, was killed in the bombing.
And we've all got to learn ourselves before we can judge someone
dead. After Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols have been arrested and charged, I frankly didn't even want trials for either one of them. I simply wanted them fried. That was the vengeance and the hate that I was living with. When I close my Texaco station at night and go home, the first thing I'd do is make a drink. And if I drank enough, when I went to bed, I could go to sleep. It was the next day that I was paying for. And this self-medication just kept escalating. One thing that I remembered that I had suppressed, hadn't thought of for almost a year, was seeing Bill McVeigh, Tim's father, on television. And he had a deep pain in his eye that I recognized immediately because I was living that same pain. I was going to need to go tell that man that I truly cared how he felt and didn't blame him or his family for what his son had done. When I knocked on his door, after I introduced myself, the first thing I said to him is, "Bill, I understand you have a nice garden in your backyard." Well, this big guy's face lit up like he'd thrown a spotlight on and didn't seem the least bit shy to me at all. And he said, "Yeah, would you like to see it?" I said, "I'd love to." Bill had asked me, he said, "Bud, can you cry?" And I thought, why is he asking this question? And I said, "Well, yeah, Bill, I can, and usually quite easily." And he said, "All of my adult life, I've been unable to cry." And he said, "I've had a lot to cry about the last 3.5 years, and I just can't do it." Well, after this long silence ended at the kitchen table, Bill looked up at the wall and just very simply said, "That's Tim's high school graduation picture." And when he said it, this great big tear rolled out of his right eye. I was able to feel in my heart that I had forgiven Tim McVeigh. When I was able to do that, I didn't release Tim McVeigh, I released myself.
So I'm going to stop right there and just, you know, for anybody who's here, what stood out to you in that video? What struck you with what Bud Welch said?
Well, the unburdening of his being by the act of forgiveness.
Yeah. That in a lot of ways, the forgiving wasn't really for Tim McVeigh. It wasn't as much even for Tim McVeigh's father, but it was for Bud's own self, that the inability to forgive actually acted like a millstone around his neck.
Well, and you must see that a lot in your work. That's the point of this series, the seminar series.
Yeah, I think I will say, I think our therapists see it more than I do. I do see it because I work with pastors. Often this is stuff that a lot of times lady don't pay as much attention to, because you wouldn't know pastors' worlds, but I see it with pastors where they've been hurt by a church. I'm working with a pastor right now who now is moving to a different church. And a large part of her moving to the different church has been me talking with her about how do you let go of the pain and forgive the church she came from, because she came straight out of seminary to go into that church and they ate her alive. And, for her, it was really painful, but it has been the work of how do you let go of them so that you can move to the new place. Our therapists definitely see it a lot more because they just, I'm the executive director, so my time, it's limited, but they're seeing person after person. What other things stood out for anyone from this?
So the starting point of saying that, of separating the act from the person, forgiving the person without forgiving the act.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't ignore what the person did, but you do disconnect what the person did from the person. Anything else? Bob Dilley, looks like you have something.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, it seemed like it took him a while to recognize that he was harming himself.
Yeah. I think that's a good insight. And part of forgiveness is self-awareness. Part of forgiveness is being able to look into myself and recognize what's going on. Any last thoughts? I'm going to keep on going. In Luke, Jesus, this is really such a central part of the Sermon on the Mount, the Sermon on the Plain. Luke and Matthew have been sort of different places, but if you've been to Israel, you kind of recognize they're kind of close to each other. Jesus says, but I say to you that, listen, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who abuse you. If anyone strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from anyone who takes away your coat, do not withhold even your shirt. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if anyone takes away your goods, do not ask for them again. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. If you do good to those who do good to you, what credit? I doubled that up. For even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to receive as much again. But love your enemies, do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be the children of the Most High, for God is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful. This is the prelude to Jesus talking about forgiveness. But what stands out to you in what Jesus said? Because this is a passage that is really foundational, not just to forgiving, but to the Christian life. What stands out to you about the personal and spiritual attitude they have? John Hayes, it looks like you have a comment or a thought.
Yeah, Graham. What I got from both the film and the text there is that unless you forgive, you cannot move on. You're a prisoner. And I have an example, a man who was identified in a lineup as a rapist by the victim. She was made a mistake in, for a lot of reasons. Later on, DNA really found that he was not the one who did this, and he was released from prison. So the woman feared he was going to come and kill her. But actually, she had a contact with him, and he said, oh my gosh, I got past this long time ago. I had to forgive you, because if I didn't forgive you, I'd never be able to move on. He was so overwhelmed by this, but I noticed the tear that the father of Tim McVeigh shed when he was able to forgive was a release of him from the hatred and judgment that he was holding in his heart, which is so damaging to the heart. And it was just like he shed a tear because he was free from that now. So unless we forgive, we are going to be constantly in prison to our judgment and our anger, and we will not be able to move on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. What other thoughts came out to you from this passage?
Well, Graham, that line of love your enemies is a really main part of what I'm doing as a volunteer in Homewood,
mm-hmm.
because there's a bunch of white folks working with the Black leaders of Homewood, and it's very hard for Black folks to accept help from white folks.
Yeah.
Just an inherent suspicion. I mean, you know the list. Therefore, it's very bumpy. It's going on 10 years. And the blessing for me is the only way I can do it is to forgive my enemies, because they act like my enemies.
Yeah.
In spite of the fact that we're trying to raise millions of dollars for them, for, you know, to help them. And that's the blessing, that I cannot do it without inherently forgiving my enemies.
Yeah, and I think what Jesus is, it's not even forgiving your enemy, but it's loving your enemy.
Yes.
And it's trusting.
Yes, that's a better
one. It's trusting who you see. And in a sense, what Jesus is saying is there's a precursor to forgiving. And the foundation, even before that, is you have to make the decision that you're going to love the other person. And yeah. I think this is what's made the polarization in our culture so difficult, is especially when Christians are in the forefront of the division, that there's this sense of, I can't trust the other because they are my enemy. You know, they are Trumpies or they are commies, you know, one or the other. And there's this complete sense of, I can't love this person. I can't trust this person because this person is going to destroy everything about me. And that's a context that actually not only makes forgiveness hard, but it just makes relationships hard. And it's not just on a national level. This takes place in families, in workplaces, et cetera. This lack of trust, this lack of love, and this constant suspicion of the other. And so there's an extent to which Jesus is saying, if you're even going to move to forgiveness, you have to work on becoming self-aware. You have to become aware of how you regard others with suspicion. You have to work on yourself in terms of how you aren't the ones trusting, because if you want them to trust you, you first have to show that you can be trusted, that you trust them. So one more, Harriet and Bob, you had a question or comment?
Yeah, it's always striking to me, and I don't know which sort of takes precedence, but you know, Jesus elsewhere says, pray for your enemies.
Yes.
Which for me is sometimes a little tougher even.
It is. It is. It is, because you know, either our enemy has hurt us or our enemy has made it difficult for us. Yeah, he does talk about it. Well, let's keep moving.
I see a hand raised from John Hayes. I don't know if that's left over.
Oh, I thought that was left over from the past one. So, John, did you have a comment or question?
No, it's all, I'm done with that.
Okay. I lowered it for you.
Yeah. So what does it mean to forgive? Looking at the root of the word, it's an interesting word. The prefix for, which means ultimate or utmost, the top, the peak, the pinnacle, plus give. It's a gift. When we forgive another person, it is the utmost or the ultimate gift we give to another. And it's interesting because you think about this spiritually, you know, how much of Christianity is based on God forgives us. God forgives us for our sin. God forgives us for what we do. You know, that forgiving is so much a part of the Christian life. Even the whole idea of Jesus on the cross saying, Father, forgive them for they know not what they're doing. You know, that there's this sense of it isn't just something that you do for another. It's something you do for yourself. It is a gift, but it's a gift that when we forgive another, it's a gift that goes both ways. And what it does, it's a relationship gift. It's a gift that what we do is we overcome barriers, we overcome obstacles, and we basically say, I am willing to find some way to give a gift to you that gives a gift to me that puts aside the pain. And it really, it's the ultimate gift we give another, and it's the ultimate gift that we can give to ourselves. And, you know, the reality is, we have a hard time deciding who to give this gift to. If somebody has really hurt us, and you know, throughout all our lives, it can be hard to say, I'm going to give this gift to a person. But think about this. When you give a gift to anyone, Christmas gift, birthday gift, whatever, or just a gift out of the blue, you know, often what makes it a gift is you're not expecting something in return. You are not expecting the other to give back a gift to you. When you give a gift, you are trying your best to give something to someone else that makes their life better. I mean, you know, one of the hard things at Christmas is as couples get older, my wife and I are heading into our 28th anniversary. You know, when you're early on in your marriage, it's very easy to give fun gifts. But as you get older, the gifts become more and more practical and more pragmatic, because it gets a little bit harder to, you know, figure out what would be really good for the other person. You know, so we may give each other screwdrivers or kitchen utensils or something like that. But the idea behind the giving is still the same. I want to give something to you that makes your life better. I want to give something to you that makes you better. But the other aspect of it is that it's an interesting gift, because when we forgive someone else, we are giving that gift back to ourselves. And that's the interesting thing about forgiveness is we're giving the utmost gift to both. One of the things that is really foundational when we forgive someone is we are responding with intention rather than with impulse. And I want you to put your self-awareness glasses on right now and dig into your own grappling with people that you may have a hard time forgiving. If you think about it, that when we have a hard time forgiving, in a lot of ways, it's us living lit more and more in our biological impulses. As you see what's there, resentment and vengeance or holding on to hostility, they're all based on biological impulses. They come from our amygdala. It comes from kind of this core part of our brain that's still kind of animal and lizard and all of that. And most of us don't realize how much biological impulses control our thoughts, our behaviors, our actions. And one of the reasons why is you can be very articulate and very philosophical and very rational sounding when you try to express reasons for why I think this way. And I the most obvious thing to me is racism. There are people who are bigots and racists, but they can come up with really very logical sounding reasons. It doesn't mean you have to accept them, but very logical sounding reasons for why I don't trust Mexicans, for why I don't trust Blacks, for why I don't trust Asians. They can, I don't trust the Chinese because they created coronavirus and that's just, spreading through everything. But ultimately what they're still doing is they're expressing something that's rooted in a biological impulse that's rooted in tribalism or that's rooted in protectivism or survivalism or whatever. What makes forgiving hard is that it is based on spiritual intent. That what we are making a choice to do is to not be rooted in biology, but to begin to become more open to spirituality. And I think this to me is a really important concept because it was something that in all my ministry, I've really been very much grounded in this idea that a significant part of what church does is it tries to move people out of mere biology and open them up to spirituality. And let me give you a different way of thinking about this. C.S. Lewis once said that humans are amphibians. We live simultaneously like frogs or other amphibians. We live simultaneously in the material world and the spiritual world at the same time. But like a frog or whatever, we are called to be immersed in the physical world, but we are called to get our air and our oxygen out of the spiritual world. And that's the struggle for Christians personally, is how do I consistently open myself up to something that is more spiritual, that is more integrating, that is open to what God wants, that seeks the way God wants me to be, and to not be controlled by biology and protectivism and survivalism. And that's really one of the struggles, because when we have something that hangs on us, something that weighs us down, it's incredibly hard to move into the spiritual, because the biological, the physical, the physiological, it screams at us so much. But it's very similar to that. This is going to sound like a ridiculous comparison, but it's not. It's very similar to that Friday night, I have the munchies and now I've just finished a whole box of crackers. If you think about it, when you get those impulses, it's very hard for you to overcome them because they're impulses, and you find yourself following these impulses, but you don't really understand why. All you know is you keep going back to the cupboard to get more crackers or cookies or pretzels or you raid the refrigerator or whatever it is that you look to do. You're getting impulses and you're following them and nothing about it is rational, but you try to bring thought into it. That's what impacts also forgiveness, is that we have impulses that hold us down. You know, so some thoughts on forgiveness that I think are important to understand as we keep going. People often confuse, well, let me stop there, because I just kind of talked about the fact that what makes it hard to forgive is our biology. Are there thoughts or comments about that and about that spiritual, physiological kind of struggle that we have? Well, if it all makes sense, I'll keep going.
Well, answering your question about who are the people that are hard to forgive, I find that I withhold forgiveness or grace or understanding when I'm not thinking of the person who has aggrieved me as a human, as a fellow traveler.
Right, and that's what your impulses do. That's what your impulses do, is they turn the other person into an object of pain or a source of pain. You know, that what happens is it dehumanizes people. And we do that all the time. I mean, you know, we dehumanize people who think differently from us. We dehumanize people of other cultures, other races, other countries. It's those thoughts aren't rooted in rationality. They're rooted in biology, but we don't necessarily think that way. Other thoughts or comments about this?
Yeah, I just...
Go ahead, John.
When the injunction to love your enemies is so counterintuitive or whatever, because if you think love is a feeling, you can't change a feeling by thinking. You can say, well, I love my enemies in the abstract, but it's just people I can't stand. I mean, it's so you see somebody and you say, well, my blood pressure just went up because I saw this person.
Right.
So what you're talking about is the biological aspect here.
It is. And Christianity calls us to question our biological impulses and to develop ways of thinking. I actually would say you can change emotions through thinking. You can't do it instantaneously. It requires work. I'm going to get into that in a little bit today, but more into the future, because that's one of the foundational tenets of counseling, is you help people change their perceptions, which helps them change their emotions. Let me keep going. Get back to the stuff. So thoughts on forgiveness. People often confuse forgiving with condoning. Condoning is ignoring, justifying, allowing, or approving. That's what Bud Welsh did not. What Bud Welsh did was he separated the act from the person. He did not condone the act. And as you heard him say, the act is unforgivable, but the person is forgivable. When we forgive, we do not condone. What we are doing is forgiving is restoring, it is transforming, and it is unburdening. That what Bud Welsh did when he began to forgive, and you know, I think it's kind of weird, because you think about, well, he didn't have to forgive Timothy McVeigh's father, but I think it's very difficult for people who've suffered trauma from an individual to also forgive the family, because there's this belief that, well, that the person who did the awful act did it because of the way the family is. And so at a deeper level, people have the tendency to blame the family. And what Bud Welsh did was he separated it. And if you get to read more of Bud Welsh's story, he and Bill McVeigh had very long conversations. And, you know, Bill McVeigh, you know, basically said, you know, we had no idea that Tim was even thinking this. And when he did it, it was, you know, everybody else was able to act with outrage, but we weren't. Everybody else was able to share their pain, but we weren't. Everybody else was able to find people who would hug them and care for them. But what happened to us is we got ignored and we got criticized and we got abandoned. And I think that's one of the things that made it so powerful when Bud Welsh did it, was Bud Welsh wasn't just, you know, unburdening himself and allowing Bill McVeigh to unburden. he was restoring not just a relationship, but he was restoring Bill McVeigh back into the culture. He was able to create an opening where Bill McVeigh could find a way to start to live again, and it became transforming for him. People also often confuse forgiving with forgetting. Forgiving is not forgetting. What forgiving does is it doesn't forget, but it transforms our memories so that we see the past differently. And in many ways, it actually changes the past. And this is really hard. This is really hard to explain. And I'm trying to think of good examples, but I'll give you an example kind of from my past. And it's going to seem stupid, but you know, when you feel anger or sadness or whatever, you know, we don't get the control over what it is. So I was a lacrosse player in high school. I grew up in Swickley. I played lacrosse at Swickley Academy. I eventually went to a college called Roanoke College in Virginia. And when I was playing between 1977 and 1981, my freshman year, I was a walk-on and I made the Roanoke College varsity team. And Roanoke College won the Division II-III national championship and finished in the year in the national rankings, ranked number four behind Johns Hopkins and Maryland and Cornell. So very high level. But the thing was, I came from Pittsburgh and I got criticized a lot while I was on that team because I didn't come from Long Island. I didn't come from Baltimore. I didn't come from the hotbed lacrosse areas. And in many ways, I played lacrosse all 4 years, but never really quite felt like I was part of the team. I just loved playing lacrosse. And, you know, interestingly enough, throughout my adult life, I would dream a lot about being on that team, but standing way down. Now, this isn't what actually happened, but I'd find myself constantly standing way down away from the whole team and being kind of, you know, am I even allowed to be here? And, you know, the coach won't put me in and blah, blah, blah. And it really dragged on me. And, you know, that what happened was it made me kind of irritated and upset with the other players, with the coach. You know, they should have done more to integrate me in. They should have done more to make me feel like part of the team. And I pay a lot of attention to that as a pastor, you know, to who doesn't feel like they're part of the team, who doesn't feel like they're part of the family. Anyway, over the years, we have had reunions of the team, of the national championship team, because it's the only one Roanoke has ever had. And I did not go to the early ones either because I couldn't go or because I held a little bit of resentment. And finally, a few years ago, I went. And it was weird because everybody accepted me in a way that they hadn't when I was playing. And I think it's, you know, after I graduated, they did think I was a very good player. I mean, I did start on the team and I did, you know, and what's interesting was their kind of conversations with me allowed me to let go of some of that pain I felt. And then going back, it made me realize, you know, they had no idea what was going on inside me. You know, and I never really jumped out and tried to hang out with any of them. I just felt kind of ignored. So I didn't really even pay much, you know, I never tried to hang out with them. I never invited any of the other lacrosse players to go out with a beer with me. You know, I frustrated the heck out of the coach because I wouldn't tell him what was going on in my head. And throughout that, you know, my experience, all of a sudden my past was different. You know, it wasn't I was being ostracized. It was also Graham was not doing much to overcome that ostracization or whatever it is. And you can kind of see. So I now look at the past differently. And I've had that experience with others, you know, of recognizing what Jesus says, Father, forgive them for they don't know what they're doing. We were all kids. You know, I didn't think so at the time, but we were all kids. And you know, this is true also with other experiences I've had. So I recognize, you know, people didn't hurt me because they wanted to hurt me. They hurt me because they were living out of their impulses. And so remember, forgiveness isn't condoning and it's not forgetting. And I'm going to start next week by showing this video because clearly I only got about halfway through what I was doing. Yeah, I'm gonna just finish with these thoughts on forgiveness, and I'll show the video next week. People often confuse forgiving with capitulation. What capitulation does is it continues to make us the victim of another. So when we forgive someone, that does not mean we forget. And it also doesn't mean, because I forgive somebody, doesn't mean I'm going to trust you. It doesn't mean I'm going to open my life back up to you. What I'm doing is what I'm clearly doing is just giving you a gift of saying, I'm not going to let you have power over me anymore. I'm not going to let my memory of what you did have power to shape my life, but I also am not going to capitulate to you. I will not make myself a victim of you again, but I am going to let go of the pain and resentment I hold towards you. This is Nelson Mandela. He basically was in prison for 25 years. And when he came out, he did not capitulate, but at the same time, he did not seek retribution either. Forgiving is letting go of victimhood and reclaiming our lives. It's basically saying, I will no longer be a victim of you, but instead I am going to live my life in a way where I'm going to unburden myself of the memory and the pain so that I can have trusting relationships with others, so that I can have normal relationships with others. Also, people often confuse forgiving with weakness. It actually takes tremendous strength to forgive. The deeper the pain, the more strength. And you all know that because you are overcoming deeply held wounds and impulses. And when we hold on to the pain and let it dominate us, interestingly enough, that weakens us. Forgiving someone is not weakness. Forgiving is strength. Because when we just let pain and resentment and hurt dominate our lives, it weakens us because it impacts how we have relationships with others, how we operate at work, how we feel about ourselves. I'm going to stop there and see if anybody has thoughts or questions or comments about what we've talked about.
Okay, I have a question, Graham, John.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
How about forgiving ourselves when, say, we feel guilty and we cannot get over that, and we know from religion, revelation, God has forgiven us a long time ago, but we can't forgive ourselves. How do we do that?
Well, that's something I'm going to get. Some of that comes from, I'm going to talk about in a couple of weeks, which is more about how to forgive.
Okay.
But other thoughts or comments about this? So what are things that you're taking away from this class to hold on to for the next week?
Graham?
Yeah, go ahead, Barbara.
I was thinking when you showed the film of Bud Welsh that it was such an ordinary situation where he's sitting at a kitchen table with Timothy McVeigh's father.
Yeah.
It's just common. Sit at the table talking, the father made the comment about that was the graduation picture of Timothy McVeigh, and then a tear came out of his eye. And that's just that's a situation where you can't be in that situation without being in a common place with somebody to see that happen, to hear that comment. And that seemed to have such an effect on Bud Welsh.
Yeah, and I think you bring out something too, which is when you forgive, in some ways forgiving it's rooted in mundane things, in basic everyday life. It's not meant to be extraordinary. It's meant to be kind of foundational. You know, that the forgiving comes about by common human acts and common human acts of love. Yeah. Dan, it looked like you had something.
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Any other takeaways from this that struck you?
No one else is asking, so let me ask another question. Let's say my name is Adolf Hitler, and I've done some terrible things, and I feel incredible guilt. What if other people can't forgive me? Does that hold me to a state of unforgivableness?
I think it makes it incredibly difficult for us to forgive ourselves. I mean, that sort of assumes Adolf Hitler had a level of self-awareness that, you know, I do think, you know, you bring up something. I think a lot of times people who do terrible acts like Hitler, Timothy McVeigh, et cetera, you know, one of the struggles is we talked about this biology. These are people who often in their lives are rooted in the deepest levels of what I would call lizard biology. You know, it's all about me. It's narcissistic. I'm the only one who really matters in the world. I have to do these acts so that I can gain dominance over the world. And it's I always think about Star Wars, you know, the Emperor, the guy who, the actor who played, you know, if you've seen the Star Wars movies, especially the first three that showed how the guy became emperor, the guy who acted in it, he plays both the emperor and also the senator Palpatine. And, you know, as senator, he's very gracious and his voice is kind and all. But he said when he acted as the emperor, if you notice, if you ever watch the film, he holds his hands out like this. And he said, what I realize is the emperor is pure lizard. You know, he's a lizard. He's like a dinosaur. And he said, lizards often hold their hands out like this. So he said, when I was acting in it, I tried to use a lizard voice. And he said, you know, I tried to use a lizard's posture, because he said, I realize everything about me is coming out of this lizard brain. And I think that's the struggle, John, is when you have somebody who's done something awful, it's they almost have to enter into a profound period of self-awareness so that they can begin to forgive themselves and admit, you know, what they've done. This is part of AA, you know, in AA, you're supposed to make a searing inventory of what you've done and then go out and seek forgiveness. You have to first become self-aware. I don't even know if that was just a ramble or whether that answered your question. Harriet and Bob, I see you have a question, and I know that we need to end, so let's just make this the last one.
Yeah, I just want to, hopefully you're going to talk about this more, but this tendency, you mentioned that this tendency to dehumanize, you know, as Derek Chauvin goes to trial this week, you know, I don't think he could have harmed Floyd in the way he did without dehumanizing him first. So
yes.
We seem to do that very easily. And I don't, that almost feels like it's at a biological level or something.
Well, it is. And, you know, one of the things I think, you know, this is an oversimplification, but one of the things a lot of neuroscientists and neurologists have recognized, people study the brain, is we have like three levels of brain. We have kind of a lizard brain. And if you think about this, you know, dinosaurs, we are always told, we always were told, like, you know, dinosaurs are huge, but they had the brain the size of an acorn or, you know, whatever. And the reason why is it was all cerebellum. Like, what's at the base of your brain? Your cerebellum, which is all about breathing, eating, fighting, defending. It's just, you know, it's fight or flight. If I just screamed right now, all of you would jump because that's part of it. Over top of that is kind of a mammalian brain, which does allow for more relationships, because like lizards are always kind of solitary, but animals can form communities and all of that. And then over that is kind of a human brain. And one of the things that we're talking about is that biological level is the more we live there, the more it's just an instinct impulsive world. And that's the challenge of spirituality is, you know, don't get rid of this, but how do we create it so there's like a structure of the spiritual guides the human, which guides the mammalian, which guides the lizard, as opposed to what happens so often in life, is people who are very sophisticated and can talk very well, but they're really just living at that lizard level. Because what happens to Derek Chauvin is he sees George Floyd as, you know, less than human. And so it doesn't matter whether he lives or dies, because in a lot of ways, George Floyd is prey. You know, now Derek Chauvin thinks he's doing this for good, but he, in that moment, you know, George Floyd is handcuffed. Well, that proves that he's bad. You know, this sounds dumb, but they've done social psychology tests on you know, putting in college where they divide the group into guards and prisoners. And they find that eventually the guards begin to treat the students who are play acting prisoners as though they really are worthless, because the whole process dehumanizes them. And I think that's true is when somebody gets arrested and put in a cop car, whether they're innocent or not, at that point, they're already dehumanized. Yeah. Well, I'm going to end here, hopefully, and I will, and Bob, next week I'll maximize. I do have a Mac, so I don't know whether I'll try maximizing my window and see if that gets rid of the people on the side. So I'm going to close this. Ted and Sarah, anything we need to do, or should I close with prayer, or are there any instructions as we